following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
The Nicole Sandler Show. Questioning authority daily. And that could be the very reason why YouTube is upset. Hey, YouTube. The music bed you hear beneath my voice is from a broadcast sound library that I paid for and have the receipts. So I've got your copyright violation right here. And now, here's Nicole.
All right. Welcome to a Wednesday. I'm Nicole Sandler. Thanks for joining us. Wow. There's a lot going on today. And we've got a really busy show for you. A little warning, we may run a little long today. So for those of you listening on the Progressive Voices Network, you may get an abbreviated interview with Lisa Graves. And I say that, I know now, because we had to tape it a couple hours ago because Lisa is in the car right now driving to a wake for a family friend. And I wanted you to be able to hear her loudly and clearly. And when someone's in the car driving during an interview, there are often dropouts and, you know, we deal with our share of really bad phone lines. So we agreed to just tape it so that there wouldn't be any of those dropouts. And the sound quality is great. So that's coming up. But it was a long interview because I had so many questions to ask her. Lisa Graves, if you're not familiar, is a legal genius. She's one of the smartest people I know. She has been a legal advisor to all three branches of government. She was deputy assistant attorney general under both Janet Reno and John Ashcroft. And she's been an advisor on the Senate Judiciary Committee. And I mean, she's got the bona fides, as they say. And so with all going on with William Barr and Trump's pardons and all the other crazy nonsense happening, I couldn't think of anyone else whose brain I'd rather pick. And she let me dig deep today. So that's coming up. But we've got other stuff to get to before we get to that. I want to start right off the bat with today's funny, because it's a long one. And I mentioned it yesterday, and I would have played it yesterday, except that Randy Rainbow had a brand new video. And so I can... why did I get blurry all of a sudden? I got to fix that. I'll fix that. Got to turn off the autofocus on the camera. I don't know why it came back on. Anyway, autofocus off. Okay. So, I digress. So this video that I'm going to play for you today, a listener sent it to me last week and it blew my mind. It's so good. I'm one of the people who actually like the original song. I know some people, my husband, don't like it, but get past that. Because the people who wrote this, and I don't know who they are, they're the founding fathers. And if you watch the video, and at this one time, if you're listening to the audio stream, I encourage you to go to my YouTube channel. You can just find it. It's YouTube/Nicole Sandler, I believe. And watch this. I will also post it on my blog today at NicoleSandler.com/2-19-20. In case you're ever looking for a show, they're always posted in that format. NicoleSandler.com/the date in month dash date dash year. You know, in the smallest number of digits possible. So anyway, that's coming up. So John Doe saying, what video? I haven't started it yet. I'm telling the people who are listening to the audio stream, for this, you'll want to check the video because the graphics on it are as perfect as the lyrics. All right. So lots of stuff coming up, but we begin with something to make you smile and make you go, wow, that's really good. All right, so take it away. The Founding Fathers sing. Here we go. The day democracy died.
A long, long time ago, a Tuesday in November, when that sinking feeling laid us low. We knew if he had his way, that we'd all live to curse the day when decency received a fatal blow. His bankruptcy's got no attention. Pussy grabbing barely mentioned. Promising a great wall. He swore to make tax rates fall. I still remember how I tried to have sympathy for his third bride. But something rumbled deep inside the day democracy died.
Everyone sing.
But no, don't let democracy die. He's a famous ignoramus, can't tell truth from a lie. And if he wins, we'll kiss our country goodbye. Singing, vote for anyone but this guy. Vote for anyone but this guy. Is Putin the one to blame?
Because
we all know it was not Ukraine who lost it by 3 million strong. And do you believe the shit he says? Repeat it by Fox talking heads. We're quite amazed they fell for such a con. All the red hat said is rallies cheer. But there must be something in the beer. Cause if they had a brain, then they know this man's insane. He was a loser bully by his dad. Kept bailing out, his debt's gone bad. He craved the love he never had. The day democracy died.
Everyone sing.
So now we're singing no.
Let democracy die.
He's a famous ignoramus, can't tell truth from a lie. And if he wins, we'll kiss our country goodbye. Singing, vote for anyone but this guy. Vote for anyone but this guy. Every 4 years, we all make a choice and try to unite our divided voice. I guess that's how it's always been. Now we find ourselves in this crazy state. And what to vote for, love or hate? And we can't ever let the darkness win. Oh, dictatorship was not our thing. But electors picked a tyrant king. And peaches sure taste sweet. Vote for anyone but this guy. Face it, face it, he's just a racist. And white is what he means by greatest. Rich and white is better, yes. A mobster with a crooked past who launder condos for autocrats. But he can't outrun the bloodhounds on his tracks. Cause the time keeps ticking like a fuse. 52% are not amused. Too many to suppress.
He's a famous ignoramus, can't tell truth from a lie. And if he wins, we'll kiss our country goodbye. Singing, vote for anyone but this guy.
Vote for anyone but this guy. Time has come to pick. in fits of rage, playing the victim well. He cast his creepy spell, and as conspiracies on Facebook flow, we flip the page and just say no, because only she would watch that show and let democracy die. We're all singing, no, don't let democracy die. Famous ignoramus can't tell truth from a lie. And if he wins, we'll kiss our country goodbye. Singing, vote for anyone but this guy. Vote for anyone but this guy. I met a girl who chose him once. Now she regrets she played the dunce. And she's a leading activist. Went down to the polling place, saw lines for miles, all happy faced, and the crowd there knows who they're not gonna pick. And on the screens the pundits shriek, a slanted poll, an angry tweet, hackers interfering, it's too late for a hearing. Good thing you and I and all our friends now realize our life depends on making sure this madness ends before democracy dies. Yeah, we're all singing, no, don't let democracy die. He's a famous ignoramus, can't tell truth from a lie. And if he wins, we'll kiss our country goodbye. Sing and vote for anyone but this guy. Vote for anyone but this guy. We're all singing, no, don't let democracy die. He's a famous ignoramus, can't tell truth from a lie. And if he wins, we'll kiss our country goodbye. Singing, vote for anyone but this guy.
Wow, wow, wow. How awesome was that? So, yeah, again, it's produced by the Founding Fathers. The Founding Fathers sing. And if you didn't see the video yet, the video is an animation. And it's George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, the signers of the Declaration of Independence, singing each verse. And as somebody in the YouTube chat room mentioned, most song parodies don't, you know, commit to the whole thing. These people took the entire 8.5 minute long song, American Pie, and did it proud. I think Don McLean, I'm hoping, would approve. I don't know what his politics are. But anyway, wow, I got chills listening to that. I will post the video on the blog today, along with today's show, at NicoleSandler.com, with today's date, 2-19-20 is how you find it. Share that. And I didn't even get a copyright violation. Obviously, they want that to be shared, and it should be. Wow. Good stuff, right? Yeah. I was hearing it in my head all day yesterday, and I didn't even play it on the air yesterday. All right. Let's see. What else? There's so much going on. I guess we should just start with the news, okay? Because there's lots to report today. So we'll do it live.
I read the news today. Oh, boy.
We'll do it live!
Okay,
do it
Bill.
Live!
All right, Bill.
I'll write it, and we'll do it live!
Thank you. Thank you, Bill. You're
fucking
done?
Fucking thing sucks!
Okay. God, get a grip, buddy. All right, Donald Trump on Tuesday took another giant leap forward in his move toward complete autocratic rule by granting clemency to 11 convicted criminals. Now, instead of following Justice Department guidelines and procedures for granting pardons, Trump relied on friends, donors, and Fox so-called news. According to the White House, yeah, they admitted this, supporters of a pardon for, say, disgraced former New York City Police Commissioner Bernie Kerik, man who was convicted of tax fraud and lying to officials, among other things, and who appeared on Fox as recently as the night before, included Fox's Judge Andrew Napolitano and Geraldo Rivera and Newsmax chief Christopher Ruddy. Nobody from the Justice Department, by the way. Junk bond king of the 80s, Michael Milken's pardon, was supported by Fox chairman Rupert Murdoch and Maria Bartiromo. Yeah, she of the bazooms. Rick Santorum, like we give a shit, supported clemency for Paul Pogue, who pleaded guilty to tax fraud and others. And the wife of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, who was convicted of trying to sell the U.S. Senate seat vacated by Barack Obama when he was elected president, is a Fox regular who's been lobbying for his pardon for years. Trump even said, "I see his wife on television." And that's all it takes for, you know, for Trump to say, "Oh, they say it on Fox, it must be true." Here's CNN's Caitlin Collins with more.
"I watched his wife on television. I don't know him very well."
Trump came close to commuting Blagojevich's sentence last summer before being talked out of it by Illinois Republicans who warned him about the blowback he'd face for intervening in what many saw as the pay-to-play scheme he campaigned against. The president also pardoned former New York City Police Commissioner Bernie Kerik, who was found guilty of 8 felonies, including tax fraud and lying to White House officials.
"Yes, I just pardoned Bernie Kerik, okay. A man who's had many recommendations from a lot of good people." You know,
the president has also watched Kerik on Fox News, where he appeared last night. Kerik was also heavily involved in the case of Eddie Gallagher, the Navy SEAL accused of war crimes, whom Trump also recently cleared. Trump didn't stop there. He also pardoned the former owner of the San Francisco 49ers, Eddie DeBartolo, who was found guilty of attempting to conceal an extortion attempt, and Michael Milken, the 1980s investment banker known as the Junk Bonds King, who has sought to wipe clean his securities fraud conviction for decades. Despite all of that, the president wouldn't say if he's considering leniency for his longtime friend Roger Stone, who is set to be sentenced in just 2 days.
"I haven't given it any thought."
Sources say that's not true, and that Trump has weighed pardoning Stone in recent weeks, as Stone's allies have lobbied the president to do so.
You think? Yeah. Now, among others, among the 11 pardoned include former CEO Ariel Friedler, who in 2014 admitted conspiring to hack into his competitors' computer systems, David Savavian, who was convicted in connection with the Abramoff corruption scandal and of perjury, and Angela Stanton, a Trump-supporting television personality. He also commuted sentences for 3 others, Tyrese Nicole Hall and Crystal Munoz, who were both convicted on drug charges, and Judith Negron, who was found guilty of Medicare fraud. Because Donald Trump does not give a shit about fighting corruption. He just wants to normalize it, I suppose. And then he actually said this yesterday after bragging to the gathered media about his pardons.
"I'm actually, I guess, the chief law enforcement officer of the country."
No, no, you're not. That would be the attorney general, who's got his own Trump issues to deal with. Yes, yeah, speaking of William Barr, Washington Post is reporting that Barr has told people close to Trump, both inside and outside the White House, that he's considering quitting over Trump's tweets about the Justice Department investigations, this according to 3 administration officials. But, you know, we're talking about Barr and Trump, and you know you can't believe a word they say, and the response has been, in a word, skeptical. Harvard law professor Lawrence Tribe tweeted, "Color me cynical, but I think all this BS about Barr considering resigning is 99% head fake and 1% wishful thinking." Former U.S. Attorney Joyce Vance tweeted about the story simply, quote, "Oh, please." Onward to 2020. Thanks to the DNC's completely rewriting the rules to qualify for their debates to favor Michael Bloomberg, the former New York City mayor will be on the stage tonight for the Democrats' Nevada debate. Since Bloomberg is funding his own campaign, the DNC removed the donor requirements. Interesting factoid, though, the other billionaire in the race, Tom Steyer, didn't qualify and will not be on the debate stage tonight. So then there were six: Biden, Bloomberg, Buttigieg, Klobuchar, Sanders, and Warren. Now, the same new polls that allow for Bloomberg to be on the stage are showing Bernie Sanders solidly in the lead in national polling. A new NBC Wall Street Journal poll issued yesterday has the senator from Vermont opening up a double-digit national lead, with Bernie at 27%, Biden down 11 points to 15, followed by Bloomberg and Warren at 14, Buttigieg 13, and Klobuchar at 7. And then a newer poll from the Washington Post and ABC released this morning concurs, except they give Sanders 32% to Biden's 16. That's half. Okay, 32% is double Biden's 16%. I'm just pointing it out. Bloomberg's at 14, Warren at 12, Buttigieg and Klobuchar at 8 and 7% respectively. And a new nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California poll finds Bernie favored again by 32% of likely voters, this time in the Super Tuesday, March 3rd California primary, followed by Biden at 14, Warren at 13, Bloomberg and Buttigieg both at 12. Again, I don't usually report on polls, but these are massive jumps in support for Bernie Sanders, while Joe Biden has just taken a massive dump. Just saying. Now, look, as regular listeners of What's News and the Nicole Sandler Show know, I've endorsed Bernie Sanders in the primary. However, at last night's CNN town hall, Bernie said he won't be releasing any more health records. Here.
This last September, you said that you would release your medical records before the primaries. You haven't done that. You have released three letters from doctors, two of them cardiologists, one is your physician. Is releasing full medical records, is that no longer something?
Now, we have released, I think, Anderson, quite as much as any other candidate has. We released two rather detailed letters from cardiologists, and we released a letter that came from the head of the U.S. Congress medical group, the physicians there. So I think we have released a detailed report, and I'm comfortable with what we have done. And by the way, you think I'm not in good health, come on out with me on the campaign trail, and I'll let you introduce me to the three or four rallies a day that we do. How's that?
Sounds good.
But just to be clear, you don't plan to release any more records?
I don't think we will, no.
That answer. For a 78-year-old candidate who suffered a heart attack a few months ago, frankly, I'm sorry, that's unacceptable. Sanders needs to provide comprehensive medical records and, on top of that, must take extra care to choose a running mate who could easily step into the commander-in-chief role if necessary. And I'm not only saying Bernie, Bloomberg, Biden, Warren, I'm sorry, and the rest of them should all release their medical records. It should be standard operating procedure. And part of the problem is there is no standard for releasing those medical records. Now, Barack Obama, who is famously a smoker, also just released a letter from his doctor saying his health is fine. Again, none of these letters, the three that Bernie released or the one that Obama released back in the day, matched up to Donald Trump's personal physician's letter. We all remember that, right? But, you know, we need some sort of a benchmark that they all need to adhere to. Just saying. One more thing happened, and I'll be honest with you. The only one of the town halls on CNN that I watched last night was Bernie's. And I'm a bit pissed off that now it seems to just be accepted nomenclature to refer to Bernie Sanders supporters as bros. I already blocked someone on Facebook today, and I've blocked numerous people on Twitter for using that offensive term. If you want to call me a bro, go for it. I think my appearance belies that notion, but, you know, hey, that's just me. Anyway, the question did come up at the town hall, and I agree. Look, I've bitched for months that some of Bernie Sanders supporters or people posing as Bernie Sanders supporters online are abusive and just plain horrible people. And here's how he answered that question last night.
For those who still need to hear it, will you condemn the Bernie bro behavior?
I will condemn absolutely anybody including my campaign or any other campaign that makes vicious personal attacks against people. What our people are involved in, we are a campaign which believes in compassion, which believes in justice. So I don't tolerate ugly attacks against anybody. But let me just say this. Talk to the people in my campaign, often the African American women in this campaign. Talk to my wife about the kind of ugly attacks that have come in to us. So right now, which is a very serious national problem, we have an internet which is essentially the Wild West. Somebody could say, hey, I'm Anderson Cooper, and Zippo, say some ugly things. And right now, that cannot be stopped. All right? So, yes, I want to have this campaign focus on the important issues facing the American people. I've just said a moment ago, as I've said many times, I'm going to support, if I don't win this thing, I'm going to support somebody else who wins it. All right? And I don't want to see terrible personal attacks. We can disagree on the issues, not personal attacks. But that is not just my campaign. We got millions of supporters out there. We've got millions and millions of supporters, and I dare say 99.9% are people who would never, ever do that. And I urge other candidates also to be mindful of these ugly personal attacks that have come into my campaign.
I just want to follow up on that. Because some of some of the other candidates have raised this issue, and I want you to be able to respond to what they said. It's been raised by Bloomberg. Also, former Vice President Biden said that you have some accountability. The Culinary Union, Nevada's largest labor union, said some of its members face online harassment after they announced concerns about Medicare.
Well, you know, as I said, I am two things. Number one, I'm totally against online bullying and harassment, and I condemn anybody who claims to speak to me. You know, I have a hard time understanding, given my views, which everybody knows, how anybody who thinks they are supporting me would do some ugly and terrible thing. But also, let me just say this, and I don't want, you know, want to be overly paranoid here, is that, you know, we live in a crazy time, and there are a lot of folks out there who do bots and all this other thing. I saw some of those things. And there are people out there who want to divide the progressive movement. I am the strongest, perhaps lifetime, supporter of unions in the United States Congress. The idea that anybody who works with me would make a vicious attack against the union leader just because we disagree on an issue is incomprehensible to me. And you know what? I'm just not sure that that's true. And anybody out there who claims to be a Bernie Sanders supporter, we work with the unions. This is a union-led campaign.
Yes, it is.
We believe in unions. We will never attack union leadership, and we will not attack people on a personal basis. We can have a debate about the issues, but I do not believe in online bullying. End of discussion.
So, of course, thank you, Bernie Sanders. And in response to that, I saw a little bit of Morning Jerk this morning. And, of course, they dissed him because nothing he can say is good enough, because they expect Bernie to get in the heads of everybody who sits at a computer and fights with people on social media. I do it. I can't help myself. I should step away from the computer sometimes. But, you know, sorry. In fact, here, I'm going to play you one more clip. This was from yesterday afternoon. Nicole Wallace, who I tend to look upon as one of the more reasonable former Republicans that MSNBC, for some reason, likes to feature during their day, had a very backhanded Bernie compliment. And I got to say, I've got newfound respect for somebody I didn't really know before, Professor Eddie Glaude, who stood up for Bernie. Here's just a 2-minute clip from a Deadline White House from yesterday.
This is where I feel like the politics of sort of the Trump hysteria take us far away from sort of the politics that when I was doing campaigns used to be the starting point. And that would be, you wouldn't deign to put forward a candidate that's nowhere with African American voters on February 14th of an election year.
Okay, and that so alone.
My campaign. Whoops. We got millions.
So hold on. I guess I'm on the record.
Shit. Okay, sorry. I thought I was able to pause it, but I guess I'm not. We thought, Bernie is doing great in the polls with African Americans and minorities. She's still pulling out that old trope that he has no support among the black community. No, I'm sorry. That would be Buttigieg. That would be Klobuchar. not Bernie Sanders, who's doing just fine, but they keep trotting out the bullshit.
I mean, how do you as a Democratic Party tell everyone to get behind someone who is, and I don't know, I have no freaking clue what Democratic Socialist means, but everyone thinks that's what he is.
Then ask him.
Scary, and he's gotten very little African-American support.
Oh, come on. No, I'm sorry. That's just plain bullshit.
Thing, but money matters too.
Okay, that is bullshit. Pure and simple bullshit. Now that I figured out how to pause this, let me back
Democratic
it up.
Democratic Socialist means, but everyone thinks that's what he is, and it sounds.
I have no idea what Democratic Socialist means. This is Nicole Wallace, who anchors her own hour on MSNBC. Invite him on your show and ask him. It's very easy. Think FDR. Look at Denmark. Look at the Scandinavian countries. Look at Canada's healthcare system. You don't know what democratic socialism is? Then shame on you. You have no business sitting behind that desk. Oh, but it gets better.
Sounds scary, and he's gotten very little African-American support.
And I have to add this. Enthusiasm is one thing, but money matters, too. You look at the people that Mike Bloomberg has been hiring, the money he's throwing out. There's a great
Listen
story in the
this.
Miami Times that
right.
just came out today.
There is no Miami Times.
A young black activist,
this,
65.
By the way, this is Jason Johnson. I don't know. He's the editor of The Root, and I guess a professor of some sort, who is a troll. And just thought I'd identify who was speaking here so you know where it's coming from.
$100 for the next 8 months. And the guy said, no, I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter, but I had to think about it because he's offering health care. I mean, Mike Bloomberg could literally change the local economy right. in certain black towns just by paying people.
Yeah, he could. So you're saying that Michael Bloomberg is worthy of the Democratic nomination because he's buying off staffers from other campaigns by offering them more money than they can legitimately turn down? $6,500 a month, that's a lot of fucking money. And this moron is saying Bloomberg could change the economy. Yeah. He also did stop and frisk. He also called transgender people it. And worse, I could go into it. Maybe we will. But, you know, back to this for a moment.
That matters. Yeah. And if you're willing to pay those people for an extended period of time.
I don't disagree with that. But I think there's a backlash to that Bernie has already taken and used to his advantage, which are people who I were talking to are absolutely repulsed by the idea that Michael Bloomberg,
would
come in, throw hundreds of millions of dollars and think that he can win votes. I mean, there is a backlash to that you need to understand is happening. Now, is it more important than the actual money itself? To be determined, I think we'd be silly to sit here and predict. But, you know, a good chunk of this Democratic Party is animated by the idea that money should be out of politics and that the fundraising apparatus and structure that Bernie's put together is, in fact, the future and the platonic ideal of how you should run a campaign.
See, I love that you use platonic ideal because I think there is still a lot of...
Okay, so anyway, this is the kind of shit that's happening on MSNBC constantly, and it gets worse. Oh, they had Steve Schmidt, all saying never Bernie. And actually, he was called out for, I don't have that clip. I'll share that with you tomorrow. Steve Schmidt, the man who was responsible for giving us Sarah Palin to be a heartbeat away, a John McCain heartbeat away from the presidency, dares to tell us who not to vote for? Are you fucking kidding me? Hi. All right. That's enough of that, because already we're running late and I want to share with you. I'm getting all riled up. So it's time to turn to Lisa Graves. Lisa Graves has been on the program before. Hopefully you've heard her. If not, be prepared. She's awesome. Let's just roll the tape, shall we? Whoops. On the line with us is the one and only Lisa Graves. Lisa has credentials like no one else that I personally know. Former Deputy Assistant Attorney General under Bill Clinton and a slew of other legal positions with a Senate Judiciary Committee and other governmental agencies. Is that a good description of you of your background, Lisa?
I worked when Ms. Reno was the Attorney General, and then also because I was a career official, I worked briefly when John Ashcroft was Attorney General, Ooh. So under two administrations. But yeah, that's so nice of you to say, and it's a joy to be on your show, Nicole.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to have you, and I so appreciate your expertise. And actually, I thought of you immediately, well, with all the things that have unfolded over the course of the last few days, starting with on Sunday, the letter written originally signed by something like 1,100 former Department of Justice officials calling for William Barr's resignation. I don't know if you were one of the original signatories of the letter, but it's up over 2,000 now, and I did see you're included among those who signed on. How did that happen? How does something like that come about?
Well, I definitely am grateful for the organizers. I didn't organize it and didn't see the original circulation of it, but I was proud to join that. And I think, as you said, the number of signatories of people who've held different leadership posts at the department is well over 2,500 attorneys. And that includes people who have served in multiple administrations, Republican and Democratic, people who have had long careers at the department. And, you know, it's unprecedented to have this sort of outpouring on a sort of transpartisan, nonpartisan basis in defense of the Justice Department and what Bill Barr has done to the department in terms of doing Mr. Trump's bidding and crossing basically the, or, you know, hitting the third rail in terms of politicizing the Justice Department. So I'm glad that letter, the list of signatories is growing. And I'm hoping that that will increase the pressure on this administration, on the Justice Department, to do something. I'm afraid that it won't in some ways, because despite the theatrics we've seen this week, in my view, my opinion, from Mr. Barr, he's doing exactly what Trump wants most of the time. And so he's not supposed to be the president's personal lawyer or the White House lawyer. He's supposed to be the head of the Justice Department, independent of the president. And his behavior is, Bill Barr's behavior is inappropriate. It's wrong morally. It violates, you know, decades, if not, you know, two centuries of tradition as a department. And he should resign in disgrace.
He should. And the calls for his resignation have been growing louder and louder. In addition to the letter we just mentioned, there's a meeting, I think, happening today. It was called by Philadelphia U.S. District Judge Cynthia Roof, or Roofy. She heads up the Independent Federal Judges Association, who said that the group couldn't wait until its spring conference to weigh in on the crisis that has enveloped Barr. And I believe this group of Federal Judges Association is meeting today over concerns about the Attorney General. This is unprecedented, isn't it?
It really is. I don't know whether there was such an organization that stood up during the Nixon impeachment with the, you know, the Saturday Night Massacre that Bork was involved in terms of firing the you know, independent investigator, independent counsel, who was investigating Nixon. But this situation is extraordinary. And as people may recall, this began a couple of years ago, but it began in earnest just a few days ago when four federal prosecutors resigned because their sentencing recommendation for Roger Stone, a dirty trickster who's closely tied to Trump and who has been convicted of serious charges, serious federal criminal violations. Those four prosecutors resigned when their sentencing recommendation for Roger Stone was interfered with by Bill Barr, by the top of the Justice Department. And then on the heels of that, Trump was attacking on Twitter the judge in the case.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad that these judges have come together to try to defend the integrity of the justice system, their independence in the justice system, and you know, to have a president who's actively attacking judges. This is not the first federal judge who he's attacked verbally, through Twitter. But this sort of effort to intervene in a federal case, both through the Justice Department and through appearing to try to apply pressure to the judge, is the behavior of, you know, autocrats. It's the behavior of a banana republic.
Yep.
It is not the normal behavior in a democracy, in a functioning democracy. It's just more evidence that Trump is out of control, that he doesn't have any respect for the boundaries of the law in our legal system, for the rule of law. And he's been rewarded by his acolytes who have embraced him despite his grotesque and disrespectful and lawless behavior.
Right. Now, Lisa, there are so many things to talk with you about today. And I you know, realized over the weekend with the letter from former DOJ officials about Barr that and his, you know, butting in on, you know, on the recommendation, sentencing recommendation for Roger Stone. So I knew I wanted to have you on. And then more stuff happened from, you know, going up to yesterday's pardon palooza by Trump. And I want to get to all of that. But let's you know, delve into Barr for a moment. When Donald Trump first named Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, many of us recoiled in horror, like Jeff Sessions, the racist, horrible senator. I couldn't think of anything worse. But actually, Jeff Sessions did the right thing in recusing himself from the Mueller investigation. For instance, he pissed Donald Trump off immediately because Donald Trump wanted his own Roy Cohn. Now, Roy Cohn was never attorney general, but there has been a history of, well, at least with Nixon, using his attorney general as his personal Roy Cohn. Was that the only other instance we have of this, or have there been more shady relationships between presidents and attorneys general?
Well, you know, one of the surprising things about the George W. Bush administration was that John Ashcroft turned out to be the best of the nominees for attorney general that Bush made, and that included his longtime lawyer, Alberto Gonzalez, who himself was embroiled in an effort to politicize the U.S. attorneys. That he had been involved in trying to push out U.S. attorneys in 2004, who had refused to peddle the false claims being pushed by Karl Rove about voter fraud. We've seen this playbook now rolled out over a number of years. And what happened was during the George W. Bush administration, U.S. attorneys who were not perceived as being good soldiers politically on that issue in terms of trying to use the office of the attorney general to promote false claims about voter fraud, they were turned out at the midterm, basically, and new U.S. attorneys were appointed in their place, which doesn't happen, which had not really happened before, that sort of effort to remove people mid, you know, in the middle of administration because they weren't pushing this political line. But then you fast forward to the current administration, and many people may recall that one of the things that that Trump did was remove the U.S. attorney who had been the U.S. attorney in New York, and he was trying to personally interview the U.S. attorney for that post, because that post is a critical post in terms of oversight over the Trump corporations and the
Preet Bharara? Is that Preet Bharara you're talking about?
Yeah, okay. Preet. And so Preet, who had previously worked for Senator Schumer and then was the U.S. attorney there, and he was a well-regarded federal prosecutor, well-regarded U.S. attorney. Trump at some point suggested he was going to keep Preet Bharara on, and then began trying to figure out who he could get who would be loyal to him in his view, and released, you know, let go of Preet from that post. And so you had the president intervening very early in his administration to try to control who, you know, not that the president doesn't appoint the U.S. attorneys, that's who appoints the U.S. attorneys across the country. However, the sort of hands-on involvement in that decision, you know, is unusual, especially when we were hearing at the time that Trump was doing these sort of loyalty tests or loyalty oaths in other ways, like with Mr. Comey and other administration officials, would they be loyal to him, which is actually not the test for an attorney general, not the test for a U.S. attorney, not the test for the head of the FBI. The idea that they're supposed to owe loyalty to a person rather than to the law is really an outrage. And so, you know, in terms of this effort to really treat the lawyers in the government, at the Justice Department, whether it's the U.S. Attorney's Office or Maine DOJ, as Trump's personal lawyers to do his bidding, is I don't think we've seen that really since the Nixon administration in terms of some of the, this is far worse in my view.
Right. Now, going back to Nixon, John Mitchell famously did jail time. Can you remind us what exactly it was that sent him to jail?
Oh, my goodness. I have to refresh my recollection, Nicole.
Because I don't remember.
I don't have that at the top, gotcha, at the tip of my tongue. But it is the case that people did time. And in fact, you know, interestingly, along with other sort of deviations in this administration, you have a whole set of people who have, you know, not testified, who've refused to come to Congress. And you have people like Roger Stone, who actually ended up being convicted of obstruction. And then in the Clinton administration, you had a woman named Susan McDougal,
right,
who refused to testify. And she went to jail for a long time,
yeah,
actually, a reasonably, yes, long time, and wrote a book, I think, from jail,
yeah,
about her experience. And so, you know, in previous administrations, there were prosecutions for refusal to testify, for refusal to give evidence. And in this situation, you know, I don't think that you've seen as much enforcement of those rules, although certainly the career attorneys at the government have been attempting to do so in some of these long investigations, like with Roger Stone and others. And now you see this president attempting to try to set aside any investigation, any conviction that was related to Robert Mueller's investigation. Robert Mueller's investigation was predicated on evidence, probable cause of criminal activity. It resulted in a number of convictions where criminal activity was proven beyond a reasonable doubt, or the person took a plea and admitted to the crime.
Right.
And now you have this president who's supposed to be enforcing the laws of the United States, upholding the Constitution, instead attempting to undo the criminal convictions of his allies, his buddies,
yep,
under his ridiculous claims that this is unfair. They violated the law. They were convicted by juries, or they pled guilty and admitted the crimes that they committed, and they should serve the time that they are required to serve.
Right, you would think. So the four prosecutors on the Stone case made their recommendation based on the law, right? They said, due to what he was convicted of, the recommended sentence should be 7 to 9 years. Donald Trump tweeted something, this is unfair, it's a witch, you know, his usual nonsense. And then, gee, how funny, within like 12 hours, William Barr says basically the same thing. But, oh, this is not because Donald Trump says so. This is my own opinion. Right. We believe that. Like we believe, and maybe you do, I don't want to put words into your mouth, Lisa, that William Barr is now saying, you know, Trump's tweets make it so hard for me to do my job. And now the Washington Post is reporting today that he has basically told some friends and confidants that he's thought about quitting because of Trump's tweeting and other interference. Do you buy that?
Well, you know, I thought that the interview that he did claiming that this was interfering with him doing his job was crocodile tears,
uh-huh,
quite frankly.
Uh-huh.
Clearly, Barr has been trying to intervene to help Trump from the moment he was appointed. In fact, he did an audition,
yep,
to do so with the memo that he circulated before he was chosen to be the attorney general. He immediately tried to distort the results of the Mueller investigation. He tried to keep that information from Congress for as long as humanly possible. He has, you know, actively intervened in this criminal prosecution of Roger Stone, who's notoriously close to the president, despite the sentencing guideline recommendations, which is what the criminal prosecutors were following, and you know, the manual that both the judges and the guidelines that the judges in federal cases and the U.S. attorneys and federal prosecutors follow. So when he went on TV saying it was hard for him to do his job, I thought that could be true in the sense that it makes it difficult for him to do the bidding of the president if the president keeps basically praising him for doing so.
Right.
But not because it makes it difficult for him to actually follow the rules and norms of the department, because he's not following the rules and norms of the department by intervening in a criminal case of a person who's closely tied to the president, who was investigated based directly on his communications about the Russian WikiLeaks, the hacking of the server, the hacking of Hillary's emails, not the server, but the email.
Right.
And so you have a situation where Barr's public claims, I just think are not believable. He certainly said them, and some people will feel like they've got to give him credit for saying them. I personally, in my opinion, don't believe that they're true. And I also, you know, I find this story that he's thinking about resigning or not resigning, you know, convenient. I don't think he's going to resign because he's doing what exactly he was chosen to do, which is help Trump in every way he can.
Exactly. And in terms of the four prosecutors who did the sentence recommendation for Stone after Barr butted in, they all four resigned from the case. They all stepped down. One of them left government service entirely. How unprecedented is it for an attorney general to step in the way Barr did in this case?
It's extraordinary. I mean, when I was at the Justice Department, this was not the type of behavior that Ms. Reno engaged in. It's not the type of behavior that would be considered acceptable. You know, and that's what the letter by so many former Justice Department officials, you know, makes clear. This is not okay. This is not normal. And, you know, Barr should have, you know, himself resigned if he if you know, given what has happened, I think he should resign longer. I don't think he should have been confirmed. I personally am hopeful about the efforts by the New York Bar to look into his law license, given the things he said and done. But, you know, I don't think that he's someone who's worthy of the position of trust of being the nation's top law enforcement officer. He's far too willing to be subservient to this president. It may be embarrassing to him to be the recipient of some of Trump's praise for his intervention, but he signed up for this job and he's been a willing soldier for this president. And unlike the former attorney general who resigned, and the former deputy who resigned rather than do the bidding of Nixon, you know, you see Barr doing it over and over and over again. I think he should actually be impeached.
Yes. Well, so do I. I fear that the Democrats now have impeachment anxiety because of what happened with the impeachment of Trump. And I honestly don't blame them for that because of just the insanity of this administration. One more question about Barr and all that. And I totally lost my train of thought. Let me move on to pardon Palooza. Lisa Graves is with us, a former Department of Justice official who has been as high up in the Clinton administration, former Deputy Assistant Attorney General. She's been a senior counsel on the Senate Judiciary Committee, has worked in some of the highest levels of government. The Donald Trump, every president has the right, the pardon, the power of the pardon pen, right? But most of them don't use it the way Donald Trump has. Were you surprised at the news yesterday of the 11 commutations and pardons that he handed down?
I'm not surprised in the sense that there's just no bottom of the barrel. There's no bar that's too low for Trump to sink to, basically.
So to speak, right?
You know, in some ways, this pardoning of all these people who've been convicted of corruption has sort of two takeaways for me. One is it obviously underscores the lie that the Trump administration was telling and its lawyers were urging before the Senate in the Senate trial, the claim that Trump was concerned about corruption in Ukraine. He's not concerned about corruption anywhere. You know, not here, not there. He is basically willing to embrace corrupt regimes and, you know, certainly the Saudi Arabian situation in terms of the murder of, you know, of
Khashoggi,
a Washington Post
right?
Writer, mm-hmm. Mr. Khashoggi. And here with these pardons, to pardon people who have been convicted of corruption it is just outlandish. But the second thing is that I think it's a precursor to lay the foundation for the pardons to come, which is the pardon of anyone that he wants to get out of their criminal sentence. Who's been involved in being who was prosecuted by Mr. Mueller. So this, you know, this is sort of, I don't know if it's feathering the nest, but it's basically laying the foundation for the pardons to come. So, you know, this is one in a series of his use of his power to basically bless corruption.
Yeah. In fact, I heard a comment from Barbara McQuaid, a former, I believe, former U.S. attorney, who said basically the same thing, that he's trying to I guess, normalize the corruption in order to, I guess, set the table for the pardons that are still to come of his cronies, those that have been convicted through the Mueller probe. The pardoning of Rod Blagojevich, I find very, very odd. He was convicted of trying to sell the U.S. Senate seat vacated by Obama when he was elected president. There's no reasonable explanation for him being pardoned. Trump used, oh, he served 8 years and his kids are in high school now and they don't get to see him except in an orange uniform. What?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't have much sympathy for the former governor of Illinois and the effort to sell off that Senate seat. In some ways, I thought there was a little bit like trolling, you know, in the sense of pardoning a Democrat or a former Democrat.
Right.
He now called himself a Trumpocrat.
Right.
So Blagojevich is, you know, clearly, however you pronounce his name, is clearly someone who has left his morals behind some time ago. So he's the perfect sort of vessel in some ways for Trump's largesse.
Right.
Trump has an affinity for people who are corrupt, have done corrupt things. Like maybe they remind him of himself. Who knows? I don't want to speculate on his state of mind per se, but this is just more of the same. Trump is someone who is fundamentally corrupt. He appears to have great appreciation, if not admiration, for other corrupt individuals and great sympathy for them. And he's someone who, as I've said before, and I'm sure you've said before, is morally unfit for the presidency of the United States of America.
Without a doubt. When it comes to pardons, presidential pardons, there's a standard operating procedure that's usually followed, right? It goes through the Justice Department based on recommendations and all kinds of vetting. In this case, we're hearing Trump didn't do any of that. Instead, he used friends, donors, and Fox News pundits to decide who he was going to pardon. But his recommendations from friends and family, is that a legitimate criteria on which to base these pardons?
Well, it is the case that when there is an effort to receive a pardon, secure a pardon, family members or friends will write letters in support of a pardon, or they may write letters to the president in support of a pardon. But the process, as it has been followed for decades now, is that it goes through the Office of Pardon Attorney at the U.S. Department of Justice, and that, you know, consideration of whether a person is worthy of a pardon, should get a pardon, is, you know, evaluated by career officials at the department, looking at the circumstances of the case and other hardships. And here you have, you know, what may be perceived by some as in some ways the selling of these pardons. I think in some ways Trump has engaged in this in terms of getting endorsements from people. I won't name names. But some of them are pretty obvious in order to pardon someone close to a celebrity, for example,
right,
whose case may be worthy of a pardon, but where you have a prominent person who could endorse the president involved. I think that's suspect and troubling. But you also have a situation where, as has been reported, as you mentioned, it appears that the basis for his decision has in part been Fox News, which is, you know, again, this sort of circle of communication where the president bypasses career officials, whether they're career officials at the Department of Defense, meaning, you know, generals and people with expertise in military and defense, or bypassing officials at the Justice Department or other agencies in order to basically do what the pundits suggest that he should do.
Yeah.
People who don't have expertise, who don't have independence, who aren't the people who are responsible for these roles. And you see that across administration activities where Trump will substitute his own bad judgment or the ridiculous claims of his, you know, closest friends on Fox for the actual judgments and recommendations of people who are civil servants or are military officials who have deep expertise that Trump disregards.
Right. Well, and he's done it with the military as well. The most recently in the case of, I think his name is Gallagher, Eddie Gallagher, the Navy SEAL who, in from what I've been able to glean, is guilty of war crimes. And Donald Trump, you know, basically pardoned him, with overrode the military brass and their recommendations. And this is, again, we use the word unprecedented so often when it comes to this president, but there's no other word to say it. He's erasing all norms.
That's right. And Eddie Gallagher was convicted by a jury of his peers in the military of war crimes. And this president has exalted him and, in essence, promoted him through his political campaign, while at the same time firing the decorated, defense officials at the White House who dared to testify, who had the courage to testify against him during the impeachment proceedings in the House. And so you have a president who has rewarded a man who's been convicted of war crimes by a jury of his peers in the military, and then try to punish military officials in good standing, in good stead, who have stellar backgrounds and recommendations for daring to speak out against Trump.
It's incredible. Alexander Vindman and his twin brother, who did nothing other than is the brother of somebody who testified. It's just mind-blowing. Lisa Grace, I remember what the other question I wanted to ask you about Bill Barr is, and that has to do with the Southern District of New York. He oversees that, right? The U.S. attorneys who prosecute cases in the Southern District of New York actually work for Bill Barr. I had been under the impression that they could bring cases against Donald Trump for his business practices in New York that would be untouched by him. Do I have that wrong? Is New York Attorney General Letitia James actually the one who could do it? Or where does all that stand?
Well, the U.S. attorney in New York, does, in essence, report to the Attorney General of the United States, although, again, under longstanding norms, the Attorney General is not supposed to be intervening in political cases on behalf of the president to pressure the U.S. Attorney's office or the attorneys in that office, which we've seen breached by Barr. But the Attorney General of the state of New York is independent of that, doesn't report to anyone except for, in essence, the people of the state of New York, and is obligated to follow the laws of the state of New York and enforce them. And so there have been reports of cooperation between the Attorney General's office of the state of New York and the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York and Eastern District of New York, perhaps. And so it's not clear what the status of those either agreements or cooperation is in this current environment. But I certainly hope personally that the state of New York will prosecute to the full extent of the law any violations of New York state law involving President Trump, his corporation, his cronies, and others who've been implicated in any of his schemes that I think may well be criminal.
You and me both. Two more very quick questions. I'm sorry, I could talk to you for hours, Lisa. I so appreciate your expertise and letting me pick your brain. Barr recently made a new rule, as far as I know, maybe it's not new, you can tell us, that any investigation of a presidential candidate must come through his office, be personally approved by him. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes, that is a new rule. There are a set of rules that the Justice Department and also the FBI follow in terms of investigations. But it is the case that there has not been any formal procedure, for example, that I know of, requiring the Attorney General to sign off on a FISA warrant, for example. So a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act warrant, where the lawyers from the Foreign Intelligence Unit, basically the National Security Unit at the Justice Department, go to the Foreign Intelligence Court, the FISA Court, and seek authority to engage in a wiretap. That is part of the ordinary process of the department to do so when it's predicated. Now, there's been a lot of confusion about this issue in terms of President Trump claiming that he himself was wiretapped or what have you.
Right.
But the fact is that those FISA warrants are predicated on the statute. Basically, if someone has contact with an agent of a foreign power, that's one of the predicates for having your communications surveilled. The idea that Barr would be involved not just in foreign intelligence matters, but domestic as well, mm-hmm. any sort of investigation of the president would have to go through him, is sort of a consolidation of power that takes away the authority, the independent authority of the officials who are tasked with enforcing those laws, whether it's in the foreign intelligence area or the domestic arena, from making their judgments based on what the facts show. That's not to say that a attorney general might not be informed in some previous administrations about cases if there's a case coming up, but where you have a situation here where this man, Bill Barr, has demonstrated over and over again his willingness to do the bidding of this president, it's extraordinarily dangerous to consolidate this power in the office of the attorney general if the attorney general has been shown to be such a political partisan sort of hack, so willing to to make the Justice Department subservient to the White House.
Right.
It's inappropriate and dangerous.
And with so much shit being thrown against the wall by this administration, stories like this get glossed over and don't get the attention they deserve. Because I heard that, and that was huge red flags. But with everything else going on, everything else that Trump is doing, the media is not spending any time on stories like this that the people need to know about. I find it astounding. And this guy is just getting away with proverbial murder day in and day out. And it's frightening. One last question for you. And it goes back to the memo that says that a sitting president can't be indicted. That's not a legal ruling. It's not a law. It's not in the Constitution. It's nowhere except the opinion of some, I guess, lawyer inside the Justice Department from decades ago. Do I have that right?
That opinion was originally drafted by the Office of Legal Counsel under President Nixon.
Wow.
And I think it was an incorrect opinion then. It was, I think that it's contrary to the plain language of the Constitution and of, the setup of our system of government. It was sort of ratified, unfortunately, by some during the Clinton administration. I was wrong then. And the idea that it has any binding effect on any other branch, would not be true, because it merely is, as you point out, the opinion of the Justice Department. However, that opinion has impact because it then constrains the activities of U.S. attorneys, or in the case of Mr. Mueller, from pursuing a prosecution of the president while he's in office. I think that's the wrong decision. I think it's a deeply flawed opinion that was mainly primarily laid out by the Nixon administration in defense of President Nixon's lawlessness. I think it should be discarded to the sort of waste bin of history where it belongs.
Yeah, no kidding. And is there nothing we can do about it? Is there nothing the Democrats or anybody could do about it while Trump is in office?
I suppose it could be challenged, but it's hard to imagine how you would have standing or who would have standing to challenge that opinion. I'm hopeful, perhaps, that in the aftermath of the multiple disasters and assaults on the rule of law by President Trump and his cronies and allies, that a new administration would clean house and would rescind that opinion by OLC.
Oh, I hope so. I hope so. Lisa Graves, you're a treasure. I thank you so much. I want to, you're starting a new position. You helped to launch a new watchdog group, True North Research. What? Tell us about it.
TrueNorthResearch.org is a new watchdog group, and we're in the process of revamping our website and starting to get some new research on there in these coming months ahead. So, excited that I'm still working with a number of other groups and colleagues on research, and happy to have a little watchdog to focus in on the bad guys, because the bad guys are doing bad, and we've got to have more hands on deck to expose them.
They are, and you do a great job with that. I should, for those who don't know, Lisa, you were one of the main people who brought the Koch brothers to our attention, brought Alec to our attention in some of your previous roles and organizations that you helped found. So I can't wait to see what you guys do at True North Research. And so as you get set up and going, I can't wait to hear what you do over there. Lisa Graves, find her on Twitter @TheLisaGraves. Find her on Facebook. Find her occasionally on Lawrence O'Donnell's show on MSNBC, and here where I can't thank you enough for joining us.
Thank you so much, Nicole. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Nicole. Bye.
And oh boy, how much do we love Lisa Graves? She just is. She's every bit as nice as she sounds. All right, we've run long, so I'm going to have to edit this for use on the Progressive Voices Network. So I will leave you on that note. Tonight is the big debate. It's on NBC and MSNBC. And beware, Chuck Todd is one of the moderators. Oh, gee, this should be fun. We'll deal with that tomorrow, and we'll have Howie Klein along, as usual. And with all the talk of Stacey Abrams perhaps being picked by Michael Bloomberg as his VP, Stacey Abrams is not a progressive. She would have been better as governor of Georgia than the idiot they have there now. But again, she was a state assembly person, I believe, maybe in the state Senate. That does not make her qualified to be president. I'm sorry. You may like her. You may not know enough about her. So I'm going to ask Howie Klein to give us a little bit of a primer on Stacey Abrams tomorrow. But those of you who are saying Bernie and Bloomberg will fight over her, no, they won't. Stacey Abrams, not really a progressive. And before you jump all over my shit, I don't think Nina Turner is the vice president pick either, or should be. I don't think she should be, to clarify. Again, she was an Ohio state senator. I think she's great. I personally love listening to her. She is not ready to step in as commander-in-chief in the event that something would happen to President Bernie Sanders. Just saying, trying to be fair here. All right, we're late. Gotta go. Gotta edit before I upload to Progressive Voices. So thank you for listening, everyone. And I'll see you tomorrow right here. Bye.